you inside the latest stories in sports business and advice from some of the best in the industry. This is BSSF's Sports Business Podcast, presented by the Business of Sports Society at Fordham. Welcome, everyone, to Season 2 of BSSF Sports Business Podcast. Glad to be back with you, Alex, for another season of BSSF Sports Business Podcast. And it's been a while since we've done one of these. We're back now. We're ready to go. Happy to be back with you, Alex. I'm excited to be doing these again.
We've been waiting to say it's Season 2 for quite a long time now, and now we're finally able to do it. So, yeah, I'm happy to hear everything is okay with you, Nick. I know it was a difficult time, and happy to be back with you virtually again. And I want to start off with some fun here, because you mentioned the last time we were doing this was November 20th of 2020. It's now March 29th as we're talking here, and I'm going to read you the description of our Episode 8. I want you to react to it just as I read it out to you. This was called The Future of Fans in Sports. Nick and Alex are back with another news roundup, this time discussing how the recent coronavirus vaccine news affects the future of fans in sports, both domestically and the upcoming Olympic Games. We also recap NASCAR's surprising success, the NCAA's plan for the upcoming college basketball season, and much more. So that last part for me really puts it in perspective as we're talking here, as March Madness is almost over. And the last time we talked was when it was just getting started and all the doubts we had about that. And now here we are.
Yes, and March Madness has gone well. Wow, that really was a while ago. It's almost 4 months. And, you know, just the way we were talking about fans and sports and how uncertain it was at that point. And now we're at a point where, you know, a lot of the teams across the country are starting to get to 10, 20% fans. It's really encouraging to see. It's quite a different picture from the end of November where we were.
There's an optimism. I mean, that's the same thing. Like, you see the vaccine rollouts getting underway, and it's at the time, November, we hadn't really had our first vaccine, or they could really even come out yet. Now we're at a point, right, like you mentioned, the baseball season rolling around. New York, which has been the most conservative when it comes to fans, going to be having fans at Yankee Stadium and Citi Field. And yeah, we're in such a different place, and there's a certain optimism about it. There's an excitement about it. You know, there's a normalcy coming around again as baseball season rolls around, and it's exciting, obviously. And obviously, we're at a much brighter tone now than I think we were all the way back in November, and it's hopefully for the better.
Yes, much brighter for sure. The Yankees and the Mets are going to open up this week with 20% fans. That'll be exciting to see at least in the New York area. The Knicks and the Rangers have been hosting 10% fans, just around 2,000 fans. New Jersey Devils had been as well. Just like you said, optimism, excitement that fans are getting back into stadiums. And even New Jersey announced yesterday or earlier today that the fans would be increasing to 20% in the state of New Jersey. So Devils fans will have be there at 20% capacity now. So just really encouraging signs from where we were, and you know, just so happy to see that on the rise, and you know, hopefully a light at the end of the tunnel to this pandemic. But overall, so happy to see fans starting to come back into sporting events. I did go to a Devils game about 2 weeks ago, and it was great. They beat the Buffalo Sabres, which isn't saying much, as seeing as though they're on, you know, at 18 game losing streak or winless streak. So it's not saying much, but you know, it's still a lot of fun to be in the arena again. And you know, they were definitely strict with wearing masks, and you know, they had people walking up and down the aisles the whole games, making sure. So they were definitely serious about it, which is good. And they were making it work. They were making it work, and it was exciting to be back at one of those games.
I'm hoping to myself go to a few baseball games this season. I'll just throw that out there. The one team I really want to see, I want to see the Nets play. I just want to see the Nets play. That is the one team where I want to see Durant, Harden. I want to see it for myself. So once they're all healthy, head out to Brooklyn. That's on my bucket list right now.
I mean, they are just forming a absolute super team over there. And for, I mean, even compared to super teams, they just signed LaMarcus Aldridge along with all of the others they had, including acquiring Blake Griffin and their big three to begin with. I mean, it is just becoming a major powerhouse, the Nets.
I want to see it.
Yeah. Hope you get out to see them. So our big conversation today is going to center around the BSSF Sports Business Symposium, our 9th annual Sports Business Symposium that we hosted this past Thursday, and you know, we hosted a great event. It was with speakers from all around the country, and we had sports business students join us from all around the country, including right here at Fordham, our club, and we were so excited to host it. It went off really, really well, and we just want to recap it for you. We thought it'd be a good idea to talk about some of the things they did, share some of their experiences, because really it was a great event and we got so much out of it. So we wanted to talk about our five different panels that we host, including two of them being keynote speakers, and share one point from each of us, which we thought was interesting or we took away from it. So that's really going to be our main conversation of the day. And we're going to start off with Mary Kane. She was our first keynote speaker, and she is a runner for Tracksmith. She was a running prodigy in USA Track, and she was an amazing runner, distance runner. She ended up going to Nike's Oregon Project under their famous head coach, Alberto Salazar, and it was an absolute nightmare. She had to face things that no athlete or person should ever have to face. You know, horrible abuse and harassment that really, really impacted her and hurt her. And it turns out hurt many others. As she was brave enough to share her story, more athletes came out about what went on at Nike. And she had a Real Sports with Brian Gumbel HBO interview done just about a month and a half ago. And they went into a deep dive on this as well, what really went in, what happened at Nike. And it was a total disaster between, you know, the testing of, you know, drugs and how much, you know, performance enhancing drugs they could take without getting caught, or, you know, just like, you know, the weight shaming and the, you know, no focus on mental health, and, you know, just terrible situation out there, and how really nothing has changed. You know, she spoke out, and so many other athletes she inspired spoke out, and they have done nothing. So very unfortunate to see, but she was an amazing speaker, very well spoken. She is actually a Gabelli School graduate here at Fordham University. She transferred here after she left Nike's Oregon Project. So she graduated from Fordham University and about 2 years ago, and she's doing much better now. Luckily, thank goodness, she's training again, running. So she was our first keynote speaker. It was amazing to hear her story. And I'm going to turn it over to you, Alex, because I want to hear, you know, what was your point that you took out from her talk with us?
A lot of really good stuff there that you mentioned, Nick. And I think for me, like you kind of said, one thing I really appreciate about Mary is just her candor and her honesty about, you know, the struggles that she faced, but more importantly about how expressing the importance for female athletes and for the industry to change. And I think she's very open about that and has been a very strong advocate of that. I think that's something you really appreciate, because like you said, it's not easy to come up with a story like this, but she was willing to do it and willing to take action on it and produce a better change, you know, and still trying to produce that change in the future. And I think she talked about a lot of the struggles that athletes face that I don't think people really consider enough. You know, there's a lot of just the performance aspect that we talk about in terms of the wins, the losses, the performance. But she talked about so much of the logistics of being an athlete that we don't really talk about, where, you know, you don't get benefits, or you don't, it's difficult to make a life as an athlete, especially for one like a runner that isn't necessarily as popular on a global stage or on a national stage. And she really highlighted to me a lot of those challenges that I've never really considered and I don't think get enough attention. And her work at Tracksmith now, where she's currently joining up with, something that makes that really stand out to me is how they treat their athletes as almost employees, not as an independent contractor. You know, they're respected as individuals, as people, not just as athletes. And I think that's so important, such a pivotal part of Mary's mission. And what she talks about is how athletes are a lot more than that. It's a common theme that we've seen talked about over the past few months and years in general. And Tracksmith really represents that. And I think that, to me, being an employee, being, you know, somebody who works outside of just her sport, is really important in setting kind of a template for where athletes and, you know, how companies should treat them moving forward. And I thought just hearing that story and how it was shaped out of her struggle, I think is a really inspirational thing to take away into the future.
For sure. And we're going to talk about Tim Pinchy in a little bit. He's the president and CEO of USA Swimming. He was our second keynote speaker. But something to what you were saying about these younger athletes really having no source of income because they're training so much and have no way to make a regular living. The USA Swimming Foundation, that's one of the main three things they do, is they give grants to all of the national team swimmers between $20,000 and $40,000 that kind of serves as their, you know, the equivalent of a salary for the year. Now, even that is not a lot of money at all to live off of, but you know, it's something, and it helps those athletes get through being able to train all the time and, you know, not being able to have that job, you know, get this grant so they can, you know, basically sustain themselves and still train and be successful. And I just know swimming a little bit better than running. So that's kind of the equivalent, but running doesn't have anything like that. So when you have a team like Tracksmith willing to do this and give their, you know, athletes, really employees, that benefit, it's a big step in the right direction for, mm-hmm. for athletes' rights. And especially, you know, women, I think in particular, because in the HBO piece, it mentions another runner who was at the Oregon Project with Nike. And they told, 3 months after having a child, and the child was in critical surgery and deathly ill. They told her 3 months after she gave birth and the day after the child's surgery, all you have to do to get your money is go win the Boston Marathon. Like, what?
Crazy.
You want me to go win the Boston Marathon after giving birth 3 months earlier? And, oh yeah, my child was just in, you know, critical life or death surgery. Like, I cannot even imagine that. So it's also a step in the right direction for athletes' rights and, you know, making sure they get paid what they deserve and, you know, just those really decent human rights.
That's exactly it. Like, I think at the end of the day, it's about treating athletes beyond just an athlete. I think that's what Mary's story highlights. That's what you just mentioned. And I want to dive deeper into USA Swimming, if it's all right with you, and talk a little bit about kind of the point that I was going to highlight. Like you mentioned there, is with Tim Hinchey, it's not just about USA Swimming, but about the USA Swimming Foundation. It's a multifaceted industry. And I think what sticks out to me about that is his focus on building from the bottom up. You know, that's something that's so important with a sport like running, is the same type of thing. It's providing a trajectory for athletes to get value, to build the foundational skills when they're younger, and then to have a pipeline where they can graduate, get older, and then compete at a national level and do it in a safe way with an organization that they know, they trust, and that's been with them from the beginning. And I think that's something that with Tim, I really gathered, is this kind of, he brought that business background to USA Swimming, streamlined the system, and it has this organizational management from top to bottom within USA Swimming. And that's something that was clearly lacking with track and USA Track and the problems that Mary Kane faced. And, you know, having that focus on the younger level on USA Swimming Foundation, having the focus on a person and along with just an athlete, I think that's really pivotal to building that success at the top. And those two things feel really connected to me. And I think that's what I kind of gathered from both Mary and Tim's experiences as well.
Right. And just to finish up on Mary, and then I'll go back to Tim. You know, the thing that stood out for me from Mary's talk was USA Track did nothing.
Yeah.
They did absolutely nothing because their biggest sponsor is Nike, and they're being paid almost over $400 million over the next 10 years. For a national governing body, that is an unbelievable sum of money. And I mean, I understand having them as a sponsor, but that is just inhumane. And especially what they were doing with the performance enhancing drugs too, from a national and international anti-doping level. I mean, that screams red flags everywhere. So, I mean, just, I can't even believe that this is, you know, going on. Like, I think, you know, in other maybe foreign countries, or, you know, even, you know, some of the more strict communist countries, like maybe in those programs. And I know for a fact in some of those programs that it exists. I've heard stories, at least from swimming, at least in the old Soviet Union, of some of the things they would do. And, you know, I was surprised that this is still going on in our day and age in the United States, no less. And it's just that, I guess, hungry power grab and money grab for Nike that creates this horrible culture in their running program. And USA Track doing nothing about it. They didn't say anything. They never even made a comment. They never responded to comment from Mary Kane's New York Times op-ed, which is how she came out with her allegations. They never even responded. And that silence was so deafening. Of course, Nike and the coach, Alberto Salazar, came out against them and attacked her. But USA Track said nothing. And nothing has changed. And unfortunately, it seems like nothing will.
When that's the national governing body of a sport, what does it say about the sport in general? Like, I think that's the biggest concern for me is, you know, you talk about that should be the best of the best at that level. And when somebody like Mary Kane highlights the inequities and the issues that exist at that level, it, I think, speaks to a much broader problem about the sport and that female athletes face within the sport, both, you know, in the performance and an individual coach, but also more broadly, like you mentioned, as a corporate level, as a structural level, you know, when the organization itself doesn't step in, you can't expect the coaches to change if the actual organization doesn't, you know, embody that change themselves. So I think there's that big connection there between, as Mary talks about, between not just about the coaches, not just about the athletes, but about the entire system surrounding running that does need to change. And like you mentioned, hopefully it will as we move forward because of stories like Mary's that we don't have to see anymore.
Right. Hopefully, but at least so far it hasn't. And that's the unfortunate thing. So we'll move on to our other keynote speaker, Tim Hinchey. He is the president and CEO of USA Swimming. And we were so honored to have him because he's the first commissioner or, you know, equivalent, you know, president and CEO of a national governing body that we've ever had at, speak at one of our symposiums. So that was a huge honor for us. And I was honored to interview him for that. And he has a wealth of sports business experience. His resume is unbelievable. Before arriving at USA Swimming, he was the team president of the Colorado Rapids and MLS, won executive of the year in 2016. Then before that, he was the CMO of Derby County, which is an English football championship team in England. So it's basically second division to the Premier League, right below it. Before that, he was the senior vice president at what is now the New Orleans Pelicans and the vice president of marketing at what is now the Charlotte Hornets. And then before that, also spent time working for Sacramento Kings, the LA Kings, and other minor league positions. Just an unbelievable resume of sports business experience. And, you know, we were honored to have him come talk, because he was really the first ever business person that, and sports business person that, that USA Swimming put at the top of the organization. In the past, you know, it had just been swimming people at the top of the organization, not sports business people. And he was the first business person they really ever had in the organization. And it's really been to their benefit. USA Swimming has improved in so many facets and so many ways, even in the short time, in the short 4 years since his hiring. He was just 2 weeks ago offered a new contract extension that'll extend through 2025 through the Paris Olympics, which is so exciting. And, you know, he's done a great job over his only 4 years so far at USA Swimming. So I know you would begin to share what you took out of it about the USA Swimming Foundation.
The one thing I was also going to add too to what you just said, and the reason why he finds the foundation so important, at least in part to me, is that he's a lifelong swimmer himself. Let's not forget that. You know, he is a guy who has still been involved in the sport and he knows the sport. And I feel like that's the perfect person that you want as a president and CEO, somebody who understands the sport at a grassroots level, at a youth level, somebody who participated in that sport at that level himself. So he understands that. And he understands the challenges. He understands the uniqueness of running an organization like USA Swimming. And as I was kind of mentioning earlier, like you said, because he's had those experiences at the younger level, he understands how important that is to building up this foundation for the future and to ensure that the sport is accessible to everybody, that it has a pipeline where athletes can start at a young age, can grow, can succeed, kind of like Tim, the path that he followed himself within the sport. And when you combine that with the important business experience, because a sport like this does need that business regimen in order to succeed as well, then when you put those two things together, you position USA Swimming in a really great place at the top and at the bottom. And you're seeing that in the early signs here of his, like you mentioned, short leadership so far. And I'm sure that's going to continue in the years ahead as the Olympics come around as well.
Yes. And you made a good point about, you know, being a lifelong swimmer, but not only being a lifelong swimmer, you know, he is the parent of three swimmers.
Ah, yeah.
He is a master swimmer still himself. And for those who don't know master swimming, it's basically like the national level of senior swimmers. So anywhere, it starts around 30 and works its way up. So that, I mean, there's even age groups for 70 and over and 80, like 77 and over. Like, it's unbelievable, some of these swimmers. So he's a master swimmer now. He's a parent of three swimmers. He was a swimmer in college, you know, and he has this amazing sports business experience. So he was, in a sense, the perfect person to lead this organization, between that swimming background, but also having so much amazing sports business background. I mean, just the resume is so impressive. And then you add on that he does know swimming, it is really exciting. And he has done so many things to improve it. And one of the ones that I took away, which he kind of mentioned on the side, but it was a really important point that he mentioned, was that USA Swimming made a heavy investment into Salesforce to grow USA Swimming. Now, that's a big risk to take, because, you know, it's a very heavy investment. Salesforce is not cheap to use, but they are the best. They are definitely the best at CRM and SEO. And for those who don't know, that's search engine optimization and customer relationship management. They are the best at that. So they're the perfect company to pair with. But for an NGO, it's interesting. And for USA Swimming, I was speaking about this a little bit before we started, was USA Swimming has really, they get a huge boost from the Olympics, you know, once every 4 years. But what happens in those other 3 years that the Olympics is not happening for swimming? And that's where this is really going to come into play. Trying to grow that online through, you know, either advertisements to some of the different games, or if they see you buying swimming equipment, maybe more Speedo ads or Tier or Arena. Those are the different swimwear companies. Maybe throwing some of those more ads in front of parents with kids and swimmers, you know, just those little things that maybe think, give parents that thought of getting their kids into swimming, or maybe kids wanting to get involved in swimming. It's such a heavy investment, but the upside is really huge and could potentially really help USA Swimming grow overall, especially in those non-Olympic years.
That's a great point. And it makes me think of a similar parallel that you've seen in something like the U.S. Tennis Association. Like, you've seen with them, the program that they've always run is the Get Out and Play initiative. You know, they're telling kids just in these, you know, because tennis is obviously a sport geared around the U.S. Open, geared around four majors. But at the same time, they're pushing a similar initiative. I think what you're seeing in USA Swimming, just get out and play, participate in the sport, and you never know what can come out of that. I think the goal for something like USA Swimming is to provide the opportunities for kids to do that. I mean, that's a big part of what Tim Henschy's done, is filtering in, like you mentioned, a partnership with Salesforce, shifting digital and getting a better organizational structure. And he's got the experience to know how to do that, you know, of other sports that have had similar success. And I think by focusing at that youth level, you just ensure the longevity of an organization like USA Swimming well into the long term. And I think you've seen that in other organizations, and you're seeing it now in USA Swimming as well. And it's just so pivotal nowadays to focus on that entire aspect of the organization beyond just the Olympics, like you mentioned, which is what I think most people would traditionally hone in on. So I think that multifaceted focus is really important. And we're seeing that with the Salesforce partnership, like you mentioned, and some other organizations as well.
Yes. And, you know, he's been trying to grow the sport in multiple ways. And, you know, one in particular was diversity and inclusion. He's done a good job incorporating more women, and especially into the board of directors, now 50% women. And now, you know, trying to work on bringing individuals from other backgrounds and cultures, more of the diversity aspect into it. You know, they've created a new alliance for African American swimmers, and a lot of them have been working directly with Tim himself. Some of those Olympic swimmers, such as Leah Neal and Simone Manuel, Cullen Jones, all great swimmers. And even Simone Manuel was the first African American woman to win a gold medal at the Olympics. She did it in Rio in the 53, such an exciting swim. I remember watching it, and you know, just amazing athletes, and hopefully can get more African-American swimmers involved, and you know, working with companies like AniSwim. And you know, that not only is that the right thing to do to really grow the sport and diversify the sport, but it does grow the sport overall. It does. And, you know, that's going to be important in the years to come. The USA Swimming Foundation, a large portion of that is for kids learning to swim and that life's potential life-saving skill, because so many kids and even adults drown every year from not knowing how to swim, whether that be in a pool, an ocean, a lake, wherever, and they don't know how to swim and they drown. It's a tragedy, but it happens so often. And that's what the foundation is really focused on, teaching kids how to swim. And, you know, if that turns into that kid swimming long-term, then that's great. But, the more important thing, of course, is them learning how to swim to avoid any such tragedies like that.
That's a really great point. And I think it highlights something that we talked about earlier with Mary Kane, is it's about more than just sports. And I think an organization has to recognize that. And like you mentioned, USA Swimming is at the forefront of that. So I think that's a really great point to highlight. And in general, a lot of the things that we've seen already from USA Swimming are just exemplary of that importance of growth, importance of growing the sport, stretching beyond the boundaries of an Olympic year, making things a little bit more widespread, and for both reasons for performance-based, but also beyond that, like you mentioned. I think that kind of dual purpose is really important to recognize. That's a great point you highlight.
Right. So we're going to move on to talking about some of our panels. We had three panels. The first one was disruptors in sports business. This is all the new technology and new trends in sports business that'll become really big soon or already beginning to really grow. And we had four speakers on this panel: Elliot Crist from the FTN Network, Matthew DeMarte of the Lotte Giants of the Korean Baseball Organization. So we even had people join us, speakers join us internationally. David Artsy, who works for AD Athlete Marketing, that's his own company, and focusing in on social media sponsorships for his athletes. And his most notable client is Austin Eckler of the Los Angeles Chargers. And then Dan Lust, he is a sports law lawyer. He's written for Forbes and goes all around the country on radio talking about sports law. So four really unique areas that are growing, fantasy sports and sports betting, sports analytics, social media marketing, and sports law. All four areas really, really growing. So it was great to have all four of these speakers on with us. So Alex, what would you say is one point you took away from these speakers?
I think for me, it's the fact that these are, like you mentioned, they're all emerging industries, all things that are growing at a rapid rate. But I also think I'm most interested by the fact that they're all almost interconnected. I feel like their growth has kind of been coinciding with each other. And something like the FTN Network kind of highlights this, where they're involved with betting that is guided by analytics and the opportunity to participate in fantasy sports. Those are three things that are all separate in one sense, but they're all kind of combined in the same way. And I feel like that's so important to mention, is like you think about something like March Madness, another prime example of this. There's the fantasy aspect of making a bracket. There's the analytical aspect of, I've got friends who tell me because someone uses a Wilson ball, they're going to win the game. I've got stuff like that. And then you've got the idea of betting, where people obviously put a lot of money on these games. So I feel like there's just such an intersection now between these three things, and they're so accessible. And now we've talked about this on the past as well, is how these opportunities have really been opened up for sports betting and for sports analytics to become an accepted part of organizations and leagues, like the Lotte Giants as an example. And talking about how they've become mainstream, their growth has been intertwined. And that's why we're seeing, I think, these type of disruptive industries growing at a similar rate, kind of alongside each other.
Yes, that's especially the sports betting is something one of the panelists on my sports partnership panel, which we'll get to in a minute, was mentioning, because MGM works with all of the leagues. And, sports betting has just exploded throughout the pandemic, especially, New Jersey initially was the first, and it surpassed Nevada for first time ever. Another state passed Nevada on sports betting. It was New Jersey. And now this past month, Michigan is the new hotspot for sports betting, with Colorado and Indiana, two other states that have really began to embrace it. But this past month, it's Michigan that's starting to really explode in sports betting. So I think across the country, once more states get it, it will start to grow there too. But really just exciting to see sports betting grow. And you're right, they're all interconnected in some way. They're all, like the sports law side of the expansion of sports betting is there's so many technicalities. There's so many laws behind it or not laws. And, where is it legal? Where is it not? What exactly is legal and what exactly isn't? There's so much that goes into it. But just, yeah, really interesting to hear from all of them. And the one point I took away was David Artsy's company about really focusing in on athlete marketing through social media and focusing in on some of the, you know, brands that want to grow through social media, through these athletes, and focusing on the social media. He doesn't do much traditional advertising, really focusing on social media through the athletes and pairing brands with those athletes on social media, which is no unique way to go about it now, and is really working. You know, I can say the one time, you know, for one of my internships, I've used, you know, influencers. I have to say I was skeptical at first, but wow, it worked. It did work. And it was something, you know, I was skeptical about initially, but it did work. And I think so many people are beginning to see that. And that's why you see social media influencers be, you know, so successful, and athletes can utilize their voice and their brand image and power through advertising on social media. And that's what I got from him.
That's something I've heard too from other people that are involved in the athlete marketing industry, is that athletes nowadays take a much more important focus on building a brand in a lot of ways, just because mm-hmm. that's almost what society demands nowadays. And it's something we talked about with Mary Kane. We're going to talk about a little bit later with the social responsibility aspect of sports and athletes and organizations. And there's just a greater cognizance of what's going on in the world, I think, from athletes. And the importance of maintaining that brand, I think, is really pivotal. And social media, obviously, a really key way to do that. So I'm with you. I think it was really interesting hearing about David's experience kind of managing those brands and how important that is nowadays. And almost, as you can mention, kind of a disruptive thing, because that wasn't always true in the past, where athletes kind of, there was the career and then there was the post-career period. Now, those two things are really intertwined, where a brand starts from the very second, you know, you sign a contract and get involved in professional sports. And I think athletes are cognizant of that, and people like David capitalizing on that with social media. So a really interesting point that you brought up there.
And it is smart for the athlete's perspective too, because, you know, once they're done with you know, whatever sport they're playing in, you know, there's usually not too many ways to make money unless you're in broadcasting or, you know, start becoming a scout or a coach or, you know, whatever it may be. You know, at least now, you know, maybe more athletes will have a larger following after they retire because of social media. And they can continue those advertisements. They can continue those partnerships because they still have a voice. Their voice is still influential. It's not like, you know, previous decades, say even go way back to, just going to throw this out there, you know, the 1950s with the Yankees, you know, obviously, you know, once Mickey Mantle retires, even take a big name, you know, there's not too many ways they can make money. I mean, maybe radio and television advertisements, but that's it. And that's even for a big player. And most of the time, those players got regular jobs after their playing careers.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's a way that these athletes can make money after their time in sports is done. And it's long term, it's a lot more profitable than actually working for a sports team. Like if you look, take LeBron James, for example, he has so many investments that now I think he's closer, at least worth over $1 billion. That's not from his salary at the Lakers. Yes, he's getting a max contract, but that's not from his salary from the Lakers. That's from his many, many investments. And, you know, long-term, it's a lot more profitable to make money after you're playing than when you're playing. That's why so many athletes focus on endorsements, because they get paid more in endorsements than they do their regular contracts. So moving on to the partnerships panel, I had the honor of hosting this panel because, you know, it's something I'm excited to hopefully get involved in for my own career. I was really excited to have five guests join me, guest speakers. Mary Beth Gamke, she is working at Barstool Sports. She's a Fordham Graduate School alum. Steve Ohl, he's Director of Corporate Partnerships over at the NYRA. They host the Belmont Stakes every year over at Belmont Park in Elmont. Terry Sarakis, Corporate Partnerships Director at LAFC. He's also a Fordham alum out on the West Coast. Mark Generelli, he is Director of Corporate Partnerships at the New York Giants, also a Fordham alum. And Stephanie Mays, she is the Director of Sports Partnerships at MGM Resorts International. So we had five really great speakers join us from across the country. Stephanie was in Las Vegas, Terry was in Los Angeles, and the three others were here in the New York area. So really glad to have a national panel for that. And I just always get excited talking about sports partnerships. So being able to talk about partnerships with them for an hour was exciting for me. I get a little nerdy with it, honestly, talking about partnerships, but I really have come to enjoy it. I've learned so much from speakers like them and so many others. So what did you take away from the partnerships panel?
Yeah, you did an awesome job moderating that. And I'll keep mine short here because this is your field. But I think the one thing, I'm an MLS guy, so I'm going to talk about Terry and LAFC really quick. And the thing that I thought was most interesting is, to me, I always get interested in what a partnership really means, you know, the extent of that. And I think LAFC was a prime example of just how far these partnerships can stretch. I think you look at something like Postmates was a prime example where it started off as something really, really minor. Then it went to food delivery. Then it went to, you know, direct partnerships with the team. And now it's all of a sudden a jersey sponsor. So like, there's a lot of details in between there that I'm not going to go through, but just in general, talking about how significant a partnership can be from starting at something that seemed relatively insignificant. Terry talked about it. They didn't know where this was going to go. And a few years later now, they're a jersey sponsor and they're one of the team's biggest partners. And I think it just is a good sign of what really a partnership means. You know, it's a lot more than just a brand label. It's a lot more than just a name. And I think that example with LAFC is just a sign of how far things can go. And another one is with Barstool and Pink Whitney. You know, they had a podcast that happened to do a little bit of a name read inadvertently, just happened to read off one of the vodka brands. The next thing you know, it's one of the leading ones in the country now because of just a mention on Barstool. So like, it's a sign of how a partnership can be a lot more than just a name. And I thought, for me, as someone who's on the outside of this, that was really interesting learning about the extent of these type of arrangements and how they can grow almost out of nothing.
Right. Partnerships can be so diverse, so interesting. You know, take Pink Whitney, for example, like you said, just to give you some numbers behind it.
Yeah.
15 million products sold and over $100 million in profits in under 3 years. That's incredible. And that's across the US and Canada, you know, just really impressive. And she was behind this with the two hosts of the Split and Chicklets podcast on Barstool Sports, Ray Whitney and Paul Bissonnette. And they started just talking about it, and all of a sudden it turned into a $100 million product, right?
Nope, out of nowhere.
Crazy. And just the different ways partnerships can happen is unique. I know Mark Generelli was talking about, you know, philanthropy being the newest big thing for partners. And it's so true. You know, the Giants have partners with, like philanthropy partners with PNC Bank, and they have the Hackensack Medical Center, the Tackle Kids Cancer. That's a big project for the Giants, and they've been working on that for many years. Eli Manning was involved with that for many years. There are so many ways to execute partnerships, and Terry and his team did an incredible job at LAFC. I mean, 10 partners signed in 2020. That is not common. That is not common. Great job to him and his team for pulling off what they did. But like you were saying, there are, this is just going back to, so many ways to execute partnerships, make them unique and interesting. McDonald's, they're sponsoring the EMLS team. So the online FIFA video gaming competition in MLS. And Postmates, now it's focusing on, you know, delivering merchandise directly to Los Angeles fans, and started around the holidays, expanded. And now it's a patch on the jersey sponsor. So, I mean, really impressive what they've been able to do out of LAFC this year. But like you said, yes, absolutely. There are so many ways to execute partnerships. And one of the things I took away from that panel was Steve Owl at the NYRA. They're getting some new neighbors. The New York Islanders are moving in next door into what will be UBS Arena once it's ready for the start of the NHL season in October. I'm excited to see how those two organizations partner. I'm envisioning, you know, days where they have horse races on the middle of the day on a Saturday. And then, you know, you get discounted tickets to the horse race. And then you go to the Islanders game afterwards. It's right next door. I'm sure those will come out in the future. I mean, I don't know if that's for sure. I want to clarify that. I don't have any inside information if that's true or not. But, you know, I can see that happening, you know, and, I, you know, they're going to be sharing parking lots. So, you know, maybe there's, you know, a time when, you know, the Islanders host, you know, community events on like a horse, on one of the horse racing days. You know, I can see a lot of potential for those two franchises working together and those two organizations. And I'm excited for, I'm excited for to see what's going to happen with those two. And, you know, another one, I'll just add another quick one, was Stephanie Mays at MGM and just really how they've been having to navigate activating partnerships, because sports betting isn't legal in all states yet. It's legal in New Jersey, Colorado, Indiana, now Michigan, you know, Pennsylvania, obviously Nevada. So there are a few states that it's really opening up now, but there's still a lot to go. And they haven't been able to advertise in a lot of those states. And I mean, they've been doing the best they can, especially with the leagues, because the leagues are still, you know, like getting their feet wet with trying to figure out how exactly we should advertise them, because they aren't legal in every state. You know, now it's accepted that you can mention it on television broadcasts and stuff like that. But it's still difficult to navigate. Still difficult to navigate, and them working directly with all the leagues, and you know, they have partnerships with the NBA, NHL, MLS, NASCAR. They have so many of the leagues signed up with them, and really they've really gotten ahead of the rest of the industry. You know, I'm interested to see over time how they're going to really start executing that partnership, because it is such a new industry, because not every state it's legal. And there is a lot to figure out with that.
Yeah, and like you said, I'm interested to see where that's going to go over time. It's a sign of kind of what we talked about earlier. Partnerships do grow over time. You know, something starts at a really small level, partnering with a league, but there's that opportunity to really grow. And it's something, like you mentioned, you know, betting is still kind of the lukewarm topic that we've talked about this a lot on this program, about how there is still kind of that mixed attitude for it. And it is a disruptive business. You know, we use that word disruptors very keenly, you know, with that panel. There's a reason why disruptors has a certain connotation, you know, because not everybody's on board just yet. There's a lot of pushback. And betting is kind of one of those areas. So like you mentioned, it is kind of a touchy subject, and a lot of great work there being done getting those partnerships. And I'm with you. That's only going to grow though in the future. Like you mentioned, you know, seeing how the pandemic has changed sports betting and altered that industry, I think it's really set a precedent that we're going to see follow in the coming years. And partnerships like this that are directly embedded in the league, I think is going to be a good way of seeing that growth happen, and certainly interesting to learn about it on that panel.
Yes, yes. The last panel we got to host was communications and community relations. You know, we had some really great speakers on that panel. That panel was loaded. We were supposed to have Jack Curry on that panel, the famous Yankees broadcaster and also very outstanding author, written multiple New York Times bestsellers and covered the Yankees and baseball for many years for the New York Times. Unfortunately, his mother-in-law passed away right before the event. So we send our condolences to him and his family because of that, his death in the family. But we still had a great, great panel together for it. Rachel Walsh, she is the Vice President of Communication at XL Sports Management. They are a big sports agency, one of the biggest in the country and represents so many athletes. Joe Favorito, the guy in sports PR. If you need a sports PR project done, you go to Joe. He is the guy, and he was outstanding to have on our panel. He's also a professor at Columbia at their graduate sports program. Outstanding individual. We've also had DJ Sixsmith. He is a host on CBS Interactive. He does host his own interview show, which I believe actually Joe was involved in for a time, which we didn't know at the time.
They knew each other.
And, you know, he had done play-by-play broadcasting in the past, all different things for CBS. And then Heather Hall, she works for the Brooklyn Nets in community relations. And there were just so many projects they are doing over there. It's really impressive to see.
Yeah, I had a lot to take away from that. This is kind of like you talked about your interest in partnerships. It's kind of something I'm more interested in. I think for me, the main just two words were definitely social responsibility. That was the number one thing that I took away from a lot of these speakers here, because they were involved in multiple areas, and hearing Heather talk about the Planting of Trees campaign with the Brooklyn Nets and about how important it was using that space outside of the arena for good and taking advantage of that and understanding the community needs and being a space, you know, because we've got to mention that, you know, arenas are spaces that of public action. You know, we've seen that around the election, turning them into voting sites, vaccination sites. Now, there's a great potential there. And she kind of emphasized the need to capitalize on that. And that's really what community relations is all about, becoming a part of the community. DJ, I think, had a similar trend, you know, him with his interview show. It's not just about athletes. It's also about entertainers, about celebrities, about people of interest who are doing good in the world and getting to understand their stories. And that's a pivotal part that he mentioned in sports, is not just being aware of sports, but being aware of the world and what's going on in it. Because as we've seen the past year, we've talked about on this show, those two things are so directly entrenched, and he hit on those really, really well. And Joe kind of a lot of the similar things when it comes to PR and understanding that cognizance of what's going on as well. And I think those are just a common theme for me, is about that awareness of the world outside of sports and about how to connect it with what's going on in the field, because nowadays those two things can't really be separate. And I thought the speakers on this panel really did a great job highlighting how important that is and emphasizing it, its place within sports, you know, in the broader world.
For sure. And, you know, the one thing I took out of this panel was something Rachel Walsh was asked about women in sports, and in particular in becoming sports agents and how they continue to break down barriers. And it's a very different, you know, work environment and landscape than even like a few short years ago, 2-3 years ago, very different. I think that was highlighted this summer, or excuse me, this winter, with Trevor Bauer and his agent. She's a young agent that's really challenging the way sports agents are paid and the way they work. You know, she was knocking down a lot of barriers as a very, not just any sports agent, but a very young sports agent, documenting the whole process over social media, and just something so unique. And I think she will be a big help in changing the industry. And she was alluding to others that will start to break down those barriers, just like Rachel Luba did for Trevor Bauer, and in getting the biggest contract of the winter for him. So, I mean, I even know someone I used to swim with who's now down at the University of Miami Law School looking to get into sports law, and in particular, wanting to become an agent. So it's incredible to see people like, you know, that swimmer I used to swim with, and others, other women getting involved in sports business, and also becoming sports agents, which is a really, really tough place for women to be successful traditionally. And hopefully that will start to change with sports agents like Rachel Luba.
Yeah, and Joe Favorito had a really poignant point about women in sports as well. And I think just a real challenge is just getting to the point where they're not called barriers anymore. You know, I think that's really the idea. Mm-hmm. You know, Rachel Walsh kind of talked about that, is, you know, there's been a lot of breaking down of barriers, and that gap is starting to close, and that's a good thing. But there's still a lot of work to do. And I think, you know, the more that community relations projects and things, you know, in this area put a place for women and a role for women, you know, within the sports industry, I think the better. And, you know, we saw it on this panel, you know, a lot of advocates for it and that have seen it in their experience and the benefits of it. And I think, you know, we have to keep pushing that agenda and get to the point where it isn't called a barrier anymore. And it's just, this is a woman at the same place in sports as men. And I think this panel kind of took one step forward in kind of creating that change. And that was really, I think, a powerful part of it.
I agree. And, you know, even at my time with the Giants in the partnership activation department, you know, the department was even. And I have to say, going in, I, you know, had a preconceived notion that it was mainly men, and it was 50-50, you know, and I was impressed to see that.
And that's a good thing.
And the Giants were really good with that.
Yeah.
And I was happy to see that. And I think other teams, like, I think on the business side, at least, I've been noticing more and more that teams are getting better with having women work for the team on the business side. But I think that change still needs to be made on the athletic side, the coaching, the scouting, the GMs, you know, that side of it is still very difficult to break in. The NFL's, we're starting to see some female coaches. Down in Miami, we have the first female GM, which is exciting to see.
Yes, Marlins.
So yeah, I mean, it's just really exciting to see women start to try and break those barriers down. And, you know, she was alluding to that. And I think it's great for sports overall. And, you know, if that's what I took out of that panel. So we're going to wrap it up with that. And just our last thing, quick game of the weekend. I know we were doing this last season. We're going to do it again. Alex, what's the big event of the weekend?
An easy one, the Final Four. And we were talking a little bit before we got started here. Our brackets are both obliterated, as most of the countries are. The Houston Cougars, my national champions, ride it out. They got the win today, one step further, and I'm feeling very confident. They will.
At least they're still in it. I mean,
very confident. The other three, we don't talk about.
All of my Final Four teams were all out four? At the end of the first round.
All four.
I got my bracket right over here. I had Iowa, Ohio State, Illinois, and Texas all out before the second round. What a mess.
You didn't have Oral Roberts on there?
I did not have Oral Roberts on there. And I actually had Loyola Chicago beating Georgia Tech, but I had them losing to Illinois. And then, of course, Loyola Chicago beat them too.
Got to stop doubting them. You got to stop.
So my bracket was totally destroyed by the end of the second round, as I'm sure many people's were. It has been a great March Madness. I really think it's been a really, really great tournament. And the athletes, the quality of play has been high despite being in that bubble. I think they've done a good job with making the facilities good. Obviously, that's almost been the controversy where the women's facilities were nothing even close to the men's facilities. But it seems like the quality of play is high. The games have been competitive for the most part. So exciting to see, the March Madness be so successful. And just quick point on the women's NCAA tournament, that was upsetting to see the weight room and the food when that came out, when that athlete from Oregon posted about all that on TikTok. Upsetting to see, but at least they rectified some of it.
We were talking about this a little bit before we started recording, and I think this is something I wanted to bring a point back to, and we've seen it with Mary Kane. We talked about it at the end with the women in sports. Things can't really change until things change at the top. And when the NCAA does that and thinks it's going to be okay, when we all obviously in a minute's span notice that it wasn't, there's obviously, you can get female coaches, you can get female players, but if things at the top aren't different, then we can't really break those barriers down. And I think that was a sign of it. And like you said, we fixed the problem, but did we find a solution? Those are two different things. So interested to see.
And then it came out that there, at least in 2019, I believe it was, that the budgets between the men's and the women's tournament was $30 million difference. That's a Title IX lawsuit waiting to happen. It really is. Don't be surprised if that is not the case going forward, that they might be mandated they're equal. Final Four definitely this weekend. Excited for that. So far, we have Houston in. Not sure about the other teams quite yet. My big event of the weekend is MLB opening weekend. Baseball is back. The Yankees are going to be opening up against the Blue Jays on Thursday. I'm excited for that. Your Mets are going to be coming around soon. The Mets are going to have new ownership with Steve Cohen. So first season under him. So I'm excited to watch the Mets play, see how they do under Steve. And obviously the Yankees, they have a ton of expectations to try and win a World Series after so many unsuccessful years with their star players not even getting to the World Series. If you think about it, the last 4 years, not only have they not won the World Series, they haven't gotten to the World Series.
I'm not a big baseball guy, Nick, but this feels like an exciting baseball year in New York. There's just a certain energy about it because the Yankees, like you mentioned, it's a make or break season, no matter how you frame it. The Mets have more expectations than they've ever had because of that ownership, because of what they did in the offseason. There's a lot on the line this year, just in baseball in general. And I'm really looking forward to it as somebody who doesn't even follow the sport as closely. I can't wait to see what happens here in New York, and it all starts this week.
Yes. You know, and I was just thinking right now, even the Dodgers, you know, they lost the World Series in 18 and 19, but at least they were in it from the National League.
And they won it.
The Yankees were never in the World Series in the last 4 years they made the runs. You know, it would either stop short in the AL Championship or before it, even in the Divisional Series. So they really have to make the World Series this year. and even win or lose, like they have to make the World Series, or else there is going to be a firestorm here in New York with the media and just the overall pressure around not making the World Series. So it'll be a good storyline to follow. The Yankees and the Mets starting up this weekend and all of baseball. So thanks everyone very much for joining us for our first episode of Season 2. We're happy to be back, and we'll see you next week for Episode 2 of Season 2. Make sure to follow us on Instagram at Fordham Sports Biz and our new website, www.bssfordham.org. We'll see you next week.